My name is Jerome Raymond Wiese. I'm nearly 63. My birthplace was Camp Atterbury, Indiana.
And what position did you serve in the war?
I was a combat medic.
Correct. Okay, take a moment. Think about the man you were, who Jerry Wiese was, right before he enlisted in Vietnam, and think about him after the war. Are those people different?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Can you tell me kind of who that person was initially and who that person was after?
Well, that person initially was just someone that had no plans in life whatsoever. He just was like a wind-up toy that bounced off one wall to the next, and whatever happened, happened. There was nothing. The person today is a little bit different. He's more mature. He's a father and a grandfather and retired, and it's a whole lot different being me today than it was being me back then.
What about that person 2 years later, though, just coming out of the war?
There was some adjustment, you know, and it was kind of difficult because I couldn't quite find the friendship that I had encountered in the military in the civilian world. I worked with a lot of good people, but once we got done with our job, we went home and that was it. In the military, you serve with them 24 hours a day.
That friendship, did you see those guys? Did you see them right after? Did you keep in contact?
The guys I served with?
Yes.
No.
Or the friendship group?
No. We actually lost contact immediately after coming back from the war. Most of us only had nicknames, and that's how we knew each other by. And as we went to Vietnam one at a time, not as a group. So when I went by myself, and I left by myself. And some of the guys I served with were there already, and they left after I got there. And some of the guys I served with came after me, and they were there when I left. But we lost contact, and it kind of bothered me because for years I really wanted to talk with them and see how they were doing. And back in 2007, a letter showed up at my doorstep, and my wife got the mail, and she presented me with a letter from a lady named Kitty Mallard, and she's from Texas, and is my understanding she's a retired private detective or something like that, and she had run me down and wrote a letter and said that the people I served with was actually looking for me as well, and that within a month and a half after this letter was there, they were actually having a reunion in St. Louis, Illinois, of all places. I mean, I could drive there in a couple hours. So I saw the guys I served with for the first time since Vietnam in May, the last part of May, 2007.
Can we back up for a second? The 40 years in between actually going to actually see them after you've been looking at them for so long, can you tell me a little about how that affected you?
I was lost. I just felt lost. There was an old saying that in Vietnam, you've probably heard this before, you go from the combat zone to the twilight zone. And there's some truth to that because you just feel like everything that you fought for, everything you learned over there, it was gone. You know, I'm not saying it was the good times, but there was some good times. I enjoyed the people I served with. They were very close to me. They were my second family. And I was just, all of a sudden, they were just gone. So it was kind of difficult for me. I worked in a large company. Can I say the name of the company?
Sure.
Kraft. Okay, and there was a lot of Vietnam veterans at Kraft, but very few combat Vietnam veterans. Most of them served in the supportive roles.
Can you talk about your relationship in Vietnam? How did this develop, and what was this friendship like?
Well, as a medic, I was actually more than a medic. I was the mailman, too. I mean, they brought all their mail to me because my aid bag had a waterproof compartment. And when we got resupplied, my job was to give the mail to the door gunners, and they would take it back and mail it. I went with them on all the patrols, initially anyway. I went with them on all the patrols, usually two a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. You live with guys like that, and like any family, there were some of us that would argue. I've got brothers and sisters I argue with today, but that doesn't mean I don't love them. It was the same way with these guys. You live with them 24/7, and there's some that you like better than the others, but you love them all. And I regarded them as my family, and whenever we were attacked or ambushed or threatened, I took it really very personal that they were trying to hurt somebody in my family.
Did you trust them? Would you say you trust them with your life? And that they trust
even
them?
Today, I would trust them with my life. You know, they're the only people I know that I would absolutely trust with my life. My wife, perhaps, but these guys for sure.
Can you kind of talk about your role as a combat medic and kind of your goal initially going into the war and what you did
well,
as a combat medic?
You want me to tell you about all the training I had?
I would just focus kind of on being a combat medic
is a little bit like a first responder. If you have a heart attack and you call the ambulance, you have somebody you hope is trained show up at your door and administer first aid to you, and they transport you to a hospital where a doctor would see you. Well, combat medic is a little bit like that. You administer first aid to them, and then you get them ready for transportation back into a real hospital with the medical personnel that know what they're doing. Now, we're kind of limited to what we can do. Our training was only 10 weeks long, so we're not doctors, never have been doctors, although there's some very good medics that probably became doctors. But we were just basically first responders.
Was that your initial desire when you enlisted?
No way. No, I did not want to be a medic at all. I wanted to be infantry. I wanted to have a machine gun in my hand. I wanted to go to war and shoot them up. But I actually became a medic instead. And
what do you think of that kind of parallel and the irony of kind of being in the infantry as the person who kills guys and then being the combat medic is the one who kind of saves them and helps them?
Actually, there wasn't much difference in being a combat medic and being an infantryman. A lot of people have the misconception that medics do not carry weapons and that they have helmets that have big red crosses on them. And that might have been true in the Second World War, but it sure wasn't true in the Vietnam War. I was a heavily armed medic. I carried 660 rounds of ammunition with me. I had two hand grenades and several smoke grenades, they call them helicopters. And until someone was actually injured, I was just another infantryman returning to fire.
Is there any specific day that sticks out to you that, as a medic, you encountered?
Yeah, April 27th, 1971. We lost 8 guys in one day. And what happened was, long story kind of short, we were operating very close to another unit of our company, the 3rd Platoon. And it was getting near dusk, and they were setting out their Claymore mines. We call them MAs, mechanical ambushes, trip flares and trip wires and Claymore mines. And there was a loud explosion. We could clearly hear that off in the distance, not too far. And we got on the radio and raised these guys on the radio and asked them what had happened. And this is what they told us. They said a turkey, if you can believe this or not, a turkey had wandered into their mechanical ambush and set off a Claymore mine. And we thought, well, that's pretty good. We're going to all have turkey instead of, you know, sea rations. And they said, no, you stay where you're at. So we kind of grumbled about a little bit. And about half an hour or so later, another explosion went off. And we thought, great, another turkey has, and I never saw a turkey in Vietnam, but that's what they said. Another turkey had hit their mechanical ambush. And we tried to raise them on the radio. We couldn't raise them. What had happened was the artillery sends out rounds. And they, if you call for artillery support, they'll tell you, look, we're going to send 10 rounds out to you. Well, you can hear 10 rounds coming in. But if you don't hear 10 explosions, maybe you hear 9, that means there's one of them out there someplace just sitting there. And that 105 round has got a lot of potential to do some damage. Normally, we would have to go out and hunt it down, and we did this on several occasions. What happened to them was a 105 round had been booby-trapped by the enemy, and they got very clustered together, and it was command detonated, and when it blew, it killed 8 of them. Actually, it killed 7 guys outright. The other guy died a day later, and then the rest of the guys in the platoon were wounded to the point that they had to ship them home. So theoretically, that platoon was wiped out, and that was a second platoon that got wiped out. One platoon got wiped out before I got there, so we lost 2 platoons in a very short period of time. And I never ever read a single word about this in Stars and Stripes. Even today, going online looking in the past, you can't find anything, but their names are on that wall, and their names are listed chronologically in that day, so I know it happened.
After that happened, what were your thoughts, and what was your first?
Well, I was only 18, and I didn't know those guys very well. Like I said, we all had nicknames. and they immediately took us out of the field. Like right now, they took us out of the field. And I didn't understand what this was all about, but they took us out of the field, and we had a memorial service back in the rear for these guys. And there was a chaplain. This was outside. It wasn't inside a building. It was outside. It was on some wooden benches that were sitting on top of some telephone pole studs. That was our benches. And when they started to mention these guys' names, they called them by their Christian names, their birth names. And I didn't really know who they were talking about because, like I said, I knew them by nicknames. There was a guy named Fast Eddie, and later I found out his name was Edward Furman, and that's why they called him Fast Eddie. But the names were alien to me. I couldn't put faces to these names. Some of the other guys had been there longer knew who they were talking about, but I didn't. You know, there was a guy named Spider, just nicknames.
Would you just describe that ceremony briefly for her? Because I don't understand. I think that's a very poignant. I don't mean to jump in, but I mean, that ceremony. Okay.
They had us, it was kind of a semicircle.
And what was it like to be part of that as a survivor?
I'd only been in Vietnam a short period of time. I'd only been in Vietnam a very short period of time, and I was still taking a lot of this country in. It kind of freaked me out in the way that this had happened so early in my tour with this company. And then when I heard, you know, that this other platoon had been wiped out, you know, it was like, wow. I was in the 11th Brigade, 4th Battalion, and it was very close to Charlie. It was very close to being in the same unit as Lieutenant Callie. And when I first got to Vietnam as a medic,
the ceremony real quick.
Okay.
And just
there was prayer. I mean, we had a moment of prayer, and they mentioned they called all their names off, and had a moment of silence, and afterwards we pretty much disbanded and went about our way, you know. Not
Did
much
your perception of the war change at all?
I was still trying to get my perception of the war at that point. I wasn't sure what I thought about the war.
Can you remember a time or remember the moment where your perception either changed or you were hit in a certain way?
A lot of the guys that had been there before me, they were pretty wise to what was going on. My age had a factor. I was only 18, and I was the youngest guy in the platoon. A lot of these guys were 20, 22 years old, and to me, they were grandpas. I mean, they were just so much older. And I thought that we were there to stop communism. That's what we had been told. At least that's what I had been told. And they were telling me, you're full of crap because this country is corrupt. They don't want to save themselves. Why should you worry about saving their country from communism? They'd be better off if it was communism. And maybe to some degree they are, since it is communism now. But at that time, I didn't believe that the company was so corrupt. And we had come out of the field off of a mission, and we were pulling bunker guard around this fire base. It was called Debbie, I believe, at the time. There's LZ Debbie, and that might have been it. But there was a dirt road not too far beyond the concertina wire. And during the daytime, you'd see people going up and down these roads with motor scooters and bicycles and ox and just walking.
Are these civilians?
These were all, well, as far as I knew, they were all civilians because the enemy had a tendency to blend in with the civilian population. I didn't trust any of the civilians. I didn't trust any of them at all. Everyone that I ever come across personally was a thief. I've had things stolen from me. It was not a big deal, but it was still a thief is a thief. I went on a thing called MedCap once. As a medic, occasionally when we came out of the field, I didn't like it, but I was plucked away from my company to go do something else. I was assigned to headquarters and headquarters command and only attached to Charlie Company. So when Charlie Company came back out of the field, sometimes they would take me and say, you need to go into the main village and basically pull sick call. And I and a couple other medics went into this village, and we were supposed to go to an orphanage, I believe, or a school. A lot of young kids, 12, 13 years old, and they were all, you know, hanging around us. And I had just made Spec 4, E4, and it was hot. And I took my jacket off, so my T-shirt was on and laid it down beside me, and it didn't take more than probably 15 seconds. That jacket was gone, and I thought, well, these people are thieving, and you couldn't find it, and I wanted to find this jacket because I had a new pack of cigarettes in the pocket. I still smoked then. It kind of pissed me off. These people would do this. And this one Vietnamese boy, a young teenager, was saying, he called me Boxy, which was what they called medics. He says, Boxy, you know, he's trying to get me to come with him. And he said he knew where it was at, so I followed him. And I followed him a couple blocks away from where we were supposed to be. And I got very, very scared. And I thought, there's no shirt or pack of cigarettes in the world worth this. So I said, you keep it. And I walked away. But what he did have was he had my Spec 4 pins. I knew he was telling me the truth because he had my rank in his hand that came off the collar.
You said you when you enlisted that you thought you were there to fight communism. Was that perception continuous throughout?
No. That perception ended immediately. I was trained to do this, but the reality of it was, and a friend of mine named Dennis Rogers, who's gone now, was the one that said, your only job is to get your butt home. You don't owe these people anything. You know, you don't owe them a damn thing. Just go home. Put your time in. Make it as simple and as easy as you can. Do not take risk and go home. And that's kind of how I took that attitude afterwards, that I don't owe them people anything. And after that, I didn't want to go on patrols. I mean, you go on them because you have to, but I didn't want to, you know.
So what did you believe was going on with the war? Why were you at war?
It's probably political, you know, guns and butter. During the Vietnam War, unemployment rate was way low. I read about this once. Companies that were making parts for the war, be it guns, bullets, food, clothing, boots, whatever, they were in production making things for the war. And certainly a certain percentage of people got knocked off in the war, which is good for the economy as well. So it was all about it, politics.
Is that why you enlisted?
No, I enlisted because the truth of the matter was my heart was broken. My girlfriend had broken up with me. Kid State was May 4th, 1970. I turned 18 May 16th, 1970, and enlisted just a couple of days later. If I could have gone into French Foreign Legion, I probably would have done that instead. But the Vietnam War was on, so I lived in Rantoul. I didn't have a car. I got on the train early in the morning, took the train from Rantoul to Champaign, got off, and the recruiter's office was right across the street from where Christie Clinic is. But at the time, there was a barber college there. A friend of mine was actually going to school at the barber college. I went to the barber college and told him to take my hair off. And he asked me why, and I told him I was going to walk across the street and join the Army. And he thought I was crazy. And he's still a friend of mine, and to this day he thinks I was crazy. And I walked across the street and had to walk through protesters from the U of I who were protesting the war of Vietnam. And I walked into the recruiter's office, and I told him I wanted to join the Army. I wanted to volunteer for Vietnam, and I wanted to ship out today. And he said, well, first of all, you cannot volunteer for Vietnam until you are trained. He said, and the second thing is it'd be impossible to ship you out today because you got to take a bunch of tests. And I said, if I don't ship out today, I'm going back home and I'm going to call it off. And he and another recruiter got together and started whispering things, and they spent all day with me taking these tests. And that afternoon, I was on the train going to Chicago for my induction. So I got what I wanted.
You talked about walking through the protesters and your friend calling you crazy. Put yourself in their shoes. Did you understand why they might have thought that?
Perhaps, you know, that wasn't my mindset. I was born on an Army base, Camp Atterbury, Indiana, during a war, the Korean War. My father was a career soldier. I lived on bases all my life. I grew up watching John Wayne and the TV show Combat. And, you know, to me, your country calls, you don't ask, you go.
I enlisted.
You know, out of all the guys that were in service, I was probably that 2% that walked in and said, I'll go. The other 98%, they had to come kick them, screaming off the campuses and all the other things. So it was not really a great thing to be a what they call a regular Army during the Vietnam War. That doesn't mean that I wasn't accepted by my friends, but when they found out that I was born on an Army base and my father was a career soldier and I had joined, for the first time in my life, I heard this term, lifer. And I thought, lifer, what's that mean? Well, I found out what it meant, but I wasn't a lifer. I got out after 22 months.
We didn't finish the story about the protesters. Could you just go back to that? And when you walked through them, could you describe what what did you see? What did you hear?
Well, I wasn't threatened, but they were.
And could you even imagine where they were coming from with that? And tell the
Today I can. Today I can. You know, but they were people in my age group that were trying to tell me, don't go in there. You know, think about what you're, excuse me, think about what you're going to do. And I was determined, no matter what, you know, if they had formed a human chain, I would probably bust it through them. I think at one point I thought that I may have to fight my way through these protesters, but it never came to that. You know, I was patriotic back then, and I'm patriotic right now. And I don't know if I agree with what they were doing, but they did what they had to do, and I did what I had to do.
Thank you.
You mentioned that your friend told you all your goal is to survive. If you knew that going into the war, would you have still joined?
Probably so. I think it was my destiny to become a soldier. All of my life, that's what I wanted to be, was a soldier. Kids played cowboy and Indians. I played Army, you know. When I went trick-or-treating, I was always dressed up as a soldier. When we would go someplace on the bases and we'd have to stop and let soldiers march by, I'd always watch these guys all in step. And it would just seem like that's what I wanted to be. And I've told my wife several times just recently, I do miss the military. It was, to me, I was only in for 22 months. Maybe I should have been a lifer, but to me, it was the greatest adventure of my life was going in the Army. I enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy the combat part of it. Don't misunderstand me. I didn't enjoy that, but I enjoyed the camaraderie. I enjoyed the travel. I enjoyed the fact that I was actually on my own, away from my family, but I really wasn't on my own. There was this invisible force, and if you made a mistake, they put you in a stockade for a timeout, take your pay away, take your rank away. So you was under their thumb, but you weren't under your mother and father's thumb.
Did you ever have a moment where you lost a sense of, like, hopelessness and being in Vietnam?
No, not in Vietnam. I lost hopelessness when I came back home, and I didn't fit in. I was just another employee. You know, all the accolades of being a combat medic didn't make no difference. You know, if you're late, you're docked, and you can be fired for doing something. And it just didn't make sense to me that all that was gone, you know. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say? When I came back from Vietnam, I was told to go to this hospital, Fort Belvoir, and work in a hospital. And there were some sergeants that, you know, they kind of got on to me because my mustache might have been a little bit past here, or sideburns, or my boots weren't shiny enough for them. And I really kind of thought, you know what, here's this guy, he's never been in combat. I still had friends in combat that were finishing their tours in Vietnam out, and this guy was really concerned about my mustache. You know, and it was hard for me to accept that this is what it's come to. Even when you came back from Vietnam and still was in the Army, you got no favoritism. None.
Do you think it affected your health in any way?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A few years ago, I contracted prostate cancer and had to go through the radiation treatment at Christie Clinic. I wasn't really aware that prostate cancer is one of the top three symptoms of Agent Orange poisoning until after I'd gone through this. When I got to looking into it, it made sense to me that possibly I could have been exposed to Agent Orange because as an infantryman, as a grunt, you know, you fill your canteens up in a stream for fresh water. You take baths in the stream, and you sleep on the ground. And certainly there were areas we'd gone through that the vegetation had been defoliated, I guess is the right word.
A grunt?
There's two types of Vietnam veterans. One is called a REMP, that's REMF, and one's called a grunt. And during the Vietnam War, they were at war with each other. The grunt is the guy that carries the rucksack on his shoulders. And obviously you're doing a lot of grunting because you're carrying all this weight around in this stifling heat. And the REMP is the guy that's got the job in the rear where there's some generator running his air conditioner and his little refrigerator's keeping his beer cold. And, you know, his boots are shiny and he's got hot food on all three of his chow is hot food. And he's got maybe a hooch maid cleans and makes his bed for him. And he writes home the horrors of war, you know, war is hell. And, yeah, that's what a REMP is. I was a grunt. You know, I spent, with the exception of for the 3 days, when our missions were over, we'd come back to the rear for 3 days and pull bunker guard around the firebases. But all the other time I was there, I was out in the field. I was out in the jungle.
What made you a grunt? Did everyone receive, was a combat medic?
No. You could have been a combat medic and worked in some big hospital in Saigon and never even seen the field. It's just the luck of the draw. But the word is combat medic, not hospital medic. So that's your first job, is being a combat medic. That's what we were trained to do.
You were a combat medic, and you told us a little bit about what your role is, but I kind of want to know your specific experiences. So what kinds of things did you do as a combat medic?
Mostly the medic was taking care of rashes, heat stroke. There was wounds, but that was not the major part. The major part was, we said, just surviving Vietnam. Every plant over there, as pretty as the place was from the air, every plant seemed to be hostile towards humans. It was either poisonous or it had thorns. It would make you itch and make you break out. So that was more. That's what I did most of the time, was take care of those things.
Okay. Did you say you had a friend? Could you tell us about the hand? Yeah.
I had a very good friend of mine from Texas, and he died about a year and a half ago. He put a big thorn in his hand, his left palm of his hand, and didn't say anything about this. And it stayed in there, and it kind of got festered up. And by the time I saw it, I thought, well, you know what? About the only thing I can do is call in a medevac helicopter and get you out of here. He didn't want to do that. He says, just cut it out of there. So after him hauling around with him, I finally said, hey, fine. So I got my surgical kit out, and I got a scalpel, and I laid his hand open, and I pulled this thing out of his hand and bandaged him up, and I've got a picture of him sticking his hand up, smiling from ear to ear. Hand is just filthy dirty. You got a Band-Aid on, and he said it was my very first open-hand surgery. But he didn't come out of the field.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, as a combat medic, you said that did a lot of combat medics carry guns, and did you?
I did. I always did. I never went out to the field without a weapon. There were a few medics that, for religious purposes, they were conscientious. I never could say the conscientious objectors that would go out without weapons. Foolish as it may be, because the enemy didn't much care if you were a medic or not. You know, they had shot anybody. A few of them changed their mind after being out in the country for a while. They wanted weapons. You know, they realized this, being a CO, doesn't make much difference. But I was fully armed. I had an M16A1. I had 660 rounds of ammunition. I carried 60 rounds in the weapon. That's two 30-round banana clips taped together so you could instantly drop one and turn around, and you got another 30 rounds. And then I had two bandoliers across me and one around my waist. And each those were 20-round mags. They weren't 30-round mags. And I believe there was 200. Yeah, 10 slots. That's 200 per. So I had 600 rounds and 60 in the with the weapon.
You said the enemy. So can you please think about the enemy for a moment? And who or what was your enemy in Vietnam? And what was it like shooting at them, maybe killing them? And was it possible in that situation to even see the enemy?
Occasionally you would see the enemy. They were very, very, they were very well adapted at hit and run. They knew that we had the ability to bring in artillery. We had the ability to bring in jets. And we could annihilate them if we knew exactly where they were at. Their tactics were basically to ambush us as quickly as they can and then diddy mount and get away from us as quickly as they can. But, yeah, occasionally you could see them. As far as shooting them up, I sleep like a baby. You know, it's not a personal thing. They were the enemy, and our job was to kill as many of them as they could, because their job was to kill as many of us as they could. I have no animosity towards them people today. My wife wanted to know if I wanted to go back to Vietnam. I said, sure, with an M16, I'd be happy to go back. But I don't want to go back to Vietnam as a visitor. No.
So, yeah, talking about the Vietnamese people and the civilians, did you have interactions with them?
Occasionally. We would have to go into villages and talk to them, and you never trusted these people. You couldn't understand what they were doing. You were frustrated with them all the time because they would constantly lie to you and tell you things that they thought you wanted to hear. And I understand now why. I mean, the average rice farmer doesn't want no part of the war either. They just want to raise rice, raise their kids, and live in peace. But they had the NVA and they had the VC on one side poking at them. They had us on the other side poking at them. They were kind of stuck in the middle. I know that statistics show that there were far more civilians killed in Vietnam than there were actual combatants, you know.
What was the drug culture like, and did you have any encounters with the drug culture?
Well, the drug culture, everybody knows about the drugs in Vietnam. Perhaps the first part of the war, it might have been not so much, but by the time I got there, the Vietnamese realized there's big bucks in them drugs, you know, and they didn't have the DEA flying over eradicating big fields of marijuana and whatnot. I got there, and I had never, ever experienced any kind of drugs at all until I got to Vietnam. And after the first mission, we came out of the field, and we were assigned these bunkers to guard, usually three or four guys per bunker. And these guys were partying hardy. They were rolling their joints and having a good time. And I was the only one looking out the window expecting the human wave attack to come any minute. And I thought, these guys aren't doing their job, and, you know, they're sloughing off. And who am I to tell these guys what to do? They've been here for months. I've only been here for a few weeks. And they told me that before I left, I would be just like them. And they were right. Before I left, I was just like them, you know.
Okay, so going back to a topic we kind of talked about before, what exactly is Agent Orange? And, explain it in a way that if you had to explain it to, like, my 10-year-old nephew, what is it?
Agent Orange is like weed control on steroids. It kills all vegetation. They would do this. They would line these planes up in a straight line, maybe the C-130s, and they would, kind of like carpet bombing, only it's Agent Orange, and they would spray. They come in low and spray the vegetation, and it might take a while for the vegetation to die. It doesn't just die like that. But, you know, along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, they used Agent Orange a lot because they could see the guys going up and down the trails, but they also used it in areas of dense jungle, you know, just to deny the enemy the ability to go in and fortify that area. I'd never heard the word Agent Orange until I came back to Vietnam. He was all, I didn't even know what it was. My mother called me up and told me there was something on TV about Agent Orange. And I had no idea what she was talking about. Later found out that it was a big deal. It was a real big deal. Obviously I'm getting benefits from the VA because of it. It's not from my wishful thinking. You know, I've got prostate cancer and I'll probably die from something like that. So it's probably shaved off a few years of my life, but.
Yeah. So you said that Agent Orange might have taken a couple years off your life, but you talk about how it wasn't a war and you got to experience true friendship and true brotherhood. So knowing what you didn't know then, would you do it all over again? And if you go back and trade not having that camaraderie for not having been exposed to Agent Orange, would you?
I wouldn't change a thing. My friendship to these guys is so strong. I wouldn't change a thing. I've experienced something with them that I could never experience anywhere in this world. You know, it's just, I've never depended on somebody like I did these guys. There's been several times that they had my back. I got excited because they were screaming, medic, medic, medic. And I remember one time I took off and left my weapon behind me, and a guy actually came dragging my weapon up and said, Doc, Doc, Doc. He says, your weapon. I said, oh, yeah, I need that too. They had my back. They wanted to take care of me. They didn't want to lose me. As a medic, when we moved from one position to the next, I generally stayed near the rear, not the last guy, but not far from the last guy. They wanted to make sure I didn't get hurt. They were happy to have me as a medic. I was their very first school-trained medic. They had what we called some shake-and-bake medics, guys that they give them 2 weeks training back at some aid station, not much, but some, and they sent them as medics. When they found out that I was a school-trained medic, they just got all excited about this. Like they got lotto, just won lotto, you know. But they took good care of me.
Okay. So, but there's this kind of balance. The military, do you ever think about the fact that the military never told you anything about Agent Orange? And how do you feel about that today? Has that ever affected you?
You know, our government, it's just not the Army. Our government, there's a lot of things our government doesn't tell us. That's just one of a million things, you know. No, it's just normal, you know.
Going back to the cause of the war itself, did you think that you were fighting for a just cause when you were there? And what did you think about the way the war ended?
I didn't care for the way the war ended at all. You know, we we actually had given the Arvins a hill called San Juan Hill. And I wasn't involved in this. I heard about this afterwards. I spent many a day on San Juan Hill pulling bunker guard. And the Arvin Army didn't want to take this hill over until it was cleaned up. As GIs, we have a tendency to throw our junk over the wire. And this hill was very tall. I showed my wife a picture of it. It's so tall that there was clouds below the top of the hill. And GIs would throw their garbage over the concertina wire. And the Arvins weren't going to take this over until it was cleaned up. So some of our guys had to go over the wire to get garbage picked up. And there was a ammo can that was on a pressure release device. And they picked the can up and it blew them away. You know, and I heard that when the North was marching through South Vietnam, that this hill was just abandoned. Just abandoned. You know, this thing about, if I can diverse for a second, the Iraqis, you know, they dropped all their equipment. And that's why you see these eyes of ISIS driving Humvees, because they left that stuff. They left it all, just dropped it and took their uniforms off. And the South Vietnamese did the same damn thing. You know, when they realized, and I asked the Vietnamese at Kraft one time, he was my wife knows who I'm talking about. He was a nice guy, but I asked him one time, why'd you guys lose? He goes, you left. You know, and that was the mentality. When you left, we lost.
Yeah, but there was a point on Wednesday we were talking, and you said you realized when you were there that the war was unwinnable. It had something to do with, like, a little girl. And could you talk about that moment with your friend? And
yeah, that was when we was, when he was telling me that the whole country was corrupt, and the black market gets everything they need, and we get what's left over, and there's some truth to that as well. And I didn't want to believe this. And he told me, we was doing bunker guard, and there was this dirt road just a short ways over the concertina wire. And he said, you pick out anybody on that road, anybody, and I'll guarantee you they'll sell you dope. And I waited and I waited, and this little girl come by. She was probably 7 or 8 years old, and I said, how about that little girl? He started yelling to her, and in French and Vietnamese and English, he made his point what he wanted. And she said, you wait, TT. And she took off the other way. And she came back and she threw a great big bag of dope over the wire. And that's when I really realized he knew what he's talking about. This is a very corrupt country we're in. And that's when I realized all I want to do is go home now. I don't care about their future. I care about mine.
So, yeah, do you ever think about that little girl and what the civilians were thinking about that at that time?
You know, no, I don't think about them too much. I know that when I first got to Vietnam, I hadn't even taken anybody's temperature yet. I was an inexperienced combat medic. And I had to put 2 weeks in at a place called the Battalion Aid Station. And that was back in Duc Pho, a town called Duc Pho. And the Battalion Aid Station is like a mash. Everything comes into that in that area. And from that, they do their triage and they ship out to more serious wounded. Or if it's just a flesh wound, they bandage them up and ship them back out. But civilians come in as well, as long as POWs too. There were some POWs came in. But a lot of the civilians were children. And I remember a lot of kids with their legs blown off. One little girl, her sister brought her in. And I distinctly remember this girl. She had it looked like a shark bite out of her leg. And she was laying there. And this girl wasn't crying or whimpering or anything. She was a real trooper. I'd have been screaming my ass off. And I'm sure that leg didn't get fixed or repaired. But we were waiting for the doctor to take her in and amputate the leg. And the POWs, you know, they came in, and I distinctly remember one POW. He was an older POW. He was laying motionless, more or less, on this stretcher. I mean, an older guy, probably my age. And he had something in his eye. He was going like this, constantly going like this. And I thought, well, you know, something's bothering his eye. So I got a wet sponge or rag or something, and I kind of wiped his eye out. And I think this guy really thought he was in some hospital in Hanoi or something, because when he could see me, he spit on me. And I thought, well, you son of a bitch. And I got a handful of sand out the front door, and I went back and put it in his eyes. I thought, you know what? It makes you understand they don't care for us, or they didn't back then. So that's probably the only time I ever really did something I'm ashamed of. I am kind of ashamed of that, but he pissed me off.
Can I interrupt just for a second? That story about the little girl was amazing. I didn't quite follow it with who was there. So could you just run through that story one more time?
Her sister actually...
Tell her to start from the beginning.
The aid station at Duck Foe was right on the perimeter of this fire base. I don't know why it was there, but she come walking up to the wire with her sister, and almost got fired up by the guys doing guard duty. But it was clear that she was carrying this girl, and she actually had to throw this girl over the wire. She knew that this was an aid station because there was a white cross out there, and we got her and took her into the aid station, and she had to go around to a main gate to get in. But this girl never cried, never. I mean, maybe she was in shock. I have no idea. But I just remember waiting and looking at this girl, and her sister came in. Her sister was probably 18, 19 years old, and holding her hand. But this girl was a real trooper. Like I said, if it had been me, I'd have been screaming.
Can you even describe what her condition was?
She, her leg right in this area. The best way to describe it, it just looked like a shark had just bit into her leg. You got to understand, in Vietnam, kids are kids, you know, and all kids play, you know. I mean, and you go out there and you set a booby trap, you know, and the kids don't know. They go out there and they set the booby trap off, and that's what happened to her. A booby trap went off, and it blew her away. But it took so much meat out of her leg, I can't possibly see how it could have survived. When it took her out, I'm sure she went in for an operation to have it amputated. I never saw her again.
Also, the girl who sold you the grass—that was that was pretty interesting. I just wasn't clear on how that happened.
That's how that happened. She sold us the dope. She got her money. She went on the road.
You just set it up with that road and everything. That was amazing.
You just set it up and tell us what your friend was telling you.
Well, we got to arguing about whether Dennis Rogers, the guy from Texas that ended up being my best friend in Vietnam. I made a comment, and I stand by it today. I would have followed him to Peking. But when I first met him, I didn't care for him. He was a bragger from Texas. Everything's big in Texas. And he was trying to educate me that the people were corrupt and the war was all about money and dollars and all this. And I didn't believe it. I was only 18. And he was the one that said, everybody in this country is corrupt and you can buy dope from anybody. I said, really? He says, pick somebody out. This dirt road was just 50 feet away from where our bunker was on the other side of the wire. And to these people, this dirt road was like a major highway, you know, an I-57. So everybody was going up and down this dirt road. And I'm sure the enemy was going up and down the dirt road as well. And I picked that little girl, and he said, fine. He stopped her, started yelling at her, and she said to wait TT. She took off, and she came back with a great big bag of dope. And, yeah, that's how that went down.
And so what impact did that have on you?
I realized right then and there he knew what he was talking about, and I didn't. You know, that I really need to listen to these guys, you know, and everything that they had told me in basic or AIT or high school didn't matter. You know, nothing matters except what's real, and that was real. I saw that with my own two eyes. All this thought about the domino effect, you know, all that stuff just went out the window.
What replaced it?
What replaced it was a guy that was just like the rest of them. Light them all up, let God sort them out, you know, that kind of mentality. No one's going to kill me for a country that doesn't want to solve its own problems. Like I say, it changed my attitude altogether. You know, I really did change. I got to where I didn't want to go on patrols after that. And as a medic, you've got to go on a certain number of patrols. When I first got there, I was going on every patrol because I was a miniature John Wayne, I guess. But when I realized that this was ridiculous to die for this country, they didn't want to solve their problems. I didn't want to go on any patrols. And then it got to the point where you got to go on some. Okay, I'll go on a couple here and there.
We had the fortune of visiting your home, and we saw a lot of security things. And sort of you described your home to us as like a castle or fort, like something of that nature. So could you use that phrase again and tell us what your home is, why your home is like your fort, and what relation does that have to what you experienced in Vietnam?
I've got 8 cameras on the outside of my house. I've got 2 in each corner. In the military, we have intersecting fields of fire. If you're setting up a machine gun position, you don't want an area that you can't shoot somebody, so they have to intersect. All my cameras are set up like intersecting fields of fire. It is virtually impossible for you to walk up to my house and not be photographed. Every door, every window including the garage door, has got a security device on it that my wife and I set when we leave and when we go to bed. I have a camera on the inside of my house so I can see what's going on in the inside of my house. I have 5 motion sensor lights. If you walk up to my house, in addition to being seen by the camera, you're going to be seen by the lights. Now, I didn't realize that this is one of the – I actually had talked to a friend of mine from Vietnam. His nickname was Baby Son, but his real name was Larry. He's in Texas as well. And he still calls me Doc, and he said, Doc, he says, that's one of the major things that they look for in PTSD is that grunts are very insecure. We're never secure enough with our perimeter. He says, if he was put a file in for PTSD, which I have not, he says, you'd probably have to talk to a psychiatrist. And that's one of the things that they look for is, are you secure at night? And I never will be totally secure. I got a dog. It's very alert. I got guns and I got my cameras and all that stuff. But you just never really 100% secure.
Do you think that these cameras replace your buddies in the platoon, and why?
I don't know if they replace my buddies. I want the cameras to stand out. I've even got a sign in the yard saying I got security. And I live, as you know, in a very nice neighborhood. It's not the slums. I don't want someone to kind of try to get to my family. I want them to leave me alone, so they're very prominent out there. But yeah, maybe they do in a way. I mean, even in Vietnam, at night we put out trip wires or trip flares. So somebody came in at night. Sometimes animals did. It set this trip flare off. But we also had mechanical ambushes. Had claymore mines, and we'd set them up. And there's a whole saying that when you blow the claymore mine, you better get down because the dinks would come in at night and they could sneak up. They're pretty good at sneaking around, too. And they could take these claymore mines and turn them around. So when you blow the claymore mine, you're actually blowing it on yourself. I saw a demonstration when I first got to Vietnam. It was at Chu Lai at a place called the Combat Center. All of us were supposed to go through this 2-day orientation thing. And there was a North Vietnamese trader or POW that decided to come and work for us. And his name, I remember his name was Khan. They called him Mr. Khan. And this instructor had a bunch of concertina wire, and they had all kinds of tin cans and trip wires and stuff. And they said, this guy used to be a zapper, you know, and he's going to show you how they sneak in. He took his time, and this guy in broad daylight made it through this without setting off any kind of device. And I thought, wow. You know, these people were very determined to kill us, you know.
Can you describe a night where you're in Vietnam and you're setting up and talk about how you wear your shoes and talk about how you have to go, how it feels to have to go away from your campsite to take a poop, you know.
Well, you know, you're setting up and you don't want to get all clustered in one location. If you got to take a whiz, you know, you can easily go take a whiz over here. The ground absorbs that. But if you have to relieve yourself, if you had to take a poop, you're not going to do that where you sleep. You need to go out on the other side of the wire. And you're not going to find anybody that goes with you. That's just something you're going to do by yourself. So you take your weapon and you go out to the beyond the wire. It may not be very far away, but it's far enough away that you're by yourself. And you pull your pants down and you kind of squat and you lay your weapon on your lap and your eyes are constantly looking, because every time I did it, I was convinced that some sniper had me in his sights, and that's probably how I'd get it, you know, out there taking a dump. Consequently, you don't want to take a dump every day. You learn to kind of hold it a little bit, you know. Well, I don't think it affects me now. I don't worry about it when I'm in my bathroom. It's just something that while I was there, I thought, if I got killed while taking a dump, you know, the Army, knowing by that time that the Army whitewashes everything, they're going to write some letter I was on a, you know, violently died, you know, doing something which is untrue. They're not going to say your son got it because he walked out here and took a dump. And your dumb son got it right between the eyes. You know, they're not going to say that. So that's what I used to think about. How would my folks hear about this? What would they think? You know.
So that's the kind of thing a grunt would encounter, right?
Every grunt would encounter. every grunt would encounter that, yeah.
As opposed to rep. And you mentioned that reps had a hooch maid. Can you tell me what that is? And
well, hooch maid would be like a civilian. You know, you might pay them something like $2 a week, and they would iron your uniforms for you. They would make your bed, change your sheets for you, shine your shoes for you. You know, I was watching an episode of MASH, and they had something on MASH. They called it a muse. And when I saw this episode, that's just a hooch maid is all that is. But that's how they made their living. You know, unemployment was in Vietnam was a big thing for these people. They had to eat, too. And they would do anything for a couple bucks a week. And that's what they did. No, I never had a hooch maid at all. But the guys in the rear all had their own private hooch maids. And maybe there's some other things going on with them, too. I don't know.
Did you ever meet a hooch maid? Oh,
I saw lots of hooch maids. Lots of them. You know, when we come out of the rear, they were all over the place. And I didn't trust them either because you could see them kind of stepping off the distance from this place to that place, and I knew what they were doing. You know, I mean, but there were these guys, hooch maids, and they trusted. But I didn't trust anybody who was different than I was race-wise. You know, I just didn't trust them.
Were there people of different races in your platoon?
Not in my platoon. In some of the other platoons, there were different races. But in my platoon, we was all white. But there were blacks, and actually we had a, take it back, there was a we called him Mafia. That was his nickname. I'm not too sure if he was Spanish or Italian, but he was not exactly all Caucasian either, but he was an arbitrator.
So back to how you were grown, can you talk about your living conditions and how difficult it was to live in the jungle? What were some of the most hardships and most difficulties?
Well, you know, people got the idea that we pop little pup tents like this and we have sleeping bags and air mattresses. That's not the case. When it's time to settle in for the night, you know, you got to clear an area, and most of these things have got roots, and you have an entrenching tool that is a small shovel. You can actually bend it like this and kind of make it into an axe, and you might be able to hack through some of the roots, but you can't get them all. I slept on the ground with a poncho on the ground to protect me from the dirt. No mattress, no nothing, just straight on the ground. And if you didn't get them all up, you'd feel them poking in the back. I didn't have a tent. I had another poncho that we would tie the neck together real tight, and we had extra boot straps or boot laces, and we'd tie them off to branches and stuff. And sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes we put mosquito netting down. That mosquito netting could be a barrier in an attack. You know, you're monkeying around trying to get out of that mosquito netting. But sometimes we put the mosquito netting down. But basically, I slept on the ground. My pillow was my aid bag, made a nice pillow, kind of. Fully clothed. I didn't get undressed for bed. I did take my boots off at night, and I had a little pair of, I call them boonie slippers, that I put on and slept with in case we had to run or get up. It was, you know, and generally, when it started getting dark, we got kind of quiet because your noise travels a lot. You want to make sure that you've already ate, because if you light any kind of fire, and by fire, I'm talking about a little C4. We use C4 to cook our sea rations, and it would burn very intense. It lights it up. I guess I should have showed you, and I probably should have brought it in, was the radio I had in Vietnam, and I didn't think about that. I had a radio that had electric lighter on the side of it, and it had a little flashlight that was used to light cigarettes at night.
Can you talk about, what about the climate and the vegetation? I mean, I'm sure there were
excuse me.
And plenty of mosquitoes. Can you talk about the climate of where you were living in the jungle?
The mosquitoes were huge. We call them B-52s. And they would buzz by your ear at night, and you could hear them buzzing by your ear. There was lots of insects, and I'm not a... Is it entomologist? I couldn't tell you. You know, they were just to me, I'd kill them all, you know, kill every one of them that crawled up on me. There were snakes, creepy crawly things that would come through at night and crawl up on you. And some of these snakes were poisonous. I watched a show where some guy was going across the Southeast Asia trying to find the world's most deadliest snakes, and one of them was in Vietnam. And when my wife saw it, she goes, "You slept out there?" Yeah. You know, they called it the bamboo viper, and the old-timers called it the two-stepper. You know, supposedly if it bit you, you had took two steps and you dropped dead. I didn't want to put it to the test. I just took it for what it was. But there was lots of creepy crawly things out there. I don't like them on me now, and I didn't like them then, but I didn't want to act like a sissy, you know, and, oh, get this off me or whatever. But it was just the environment you had to put up with like everybody else. It was in the jungle. There wasn't any breeze to speak of. The breeze was up above the trees and not down where you were at. So, you know, at nighttime, it cooled off a little bit, but not a lot. And in the daytime, it was just like living in a sauna.
Can I throw out a follow-up? What did it smell like, and what sort of sounds did you hear?
Well, you know, I don't know that it smelled like anything. If anything smelled, it was probably us that smelled, you know, just your own perspiration. As far as sounds, we didn't hear any hoot owls, no coyotes, nothing like that. You know, you watch these TV shows and hear these jungle noises, it's hoo, hoo, ha, ha. I can't really recall hearing anything like that in the jungle. You occasionally would hear something snap, and there were some orangutans, and there were some apes out there. There was a few tigers, not many, but there was actually tigers out there, and I guess there was even some wild elephant left in Vietnam. You'd hear animals moving about, and, you know, in fact, we've lit some animals up, you know, on guard duty because you can't take any chances. You know, orangutan moving across the moonlight, if you can see them at all, looks an awful lot like a dink, you know, and you can't take any chances. So you light them up, and in the morning you think, well, I just wasted $1 million for a monkey. Well, better safe than sorry. You know, but I'm not sure if that answered your question or not, but.
Traveling through the jungle, how difficult was it to traverse through, like, the vegetation?
You know, you had to hack your way through a lot of stuff. When I got there, when I first got there, the hand grenades that we were using, we had two little lapels on our rucksack to put these hand grenades in, but the hand grenades had a twisty, had a twisty tie on them. And I thought, what's this all about? And I found out later that a lot of guys, because of the vines and stuff, they would get in the jungle and these vines would get wrapped in their hand grenades and they would pull, and they'd pull the pins out of these hand grenades and blow themselves up. So the Army thought, well, we'll solve that problem. We'll put twist ties around the hand grenades. The only problem with that is you got to remember to take the twisty tie off when you throw it or the dinks pick it up and throw it right back at you. But to answer your question about the vegetation, yeah, you had to hack your way through some of the stuff. You know, again, as a medic, I was near the rear of the column, you know, and for the most part, all the hacking part was done by the time I got there. I was kind of concerned about booby traps. And as I told you guys last...
Yeah, could you tell that story about that?
No, you know, you know the booby traps killed a lot of guys on that wall. And that's how, you know, a large majority of them met their maker. You know, there was 18 guys in my platoon at one point. At one point, we were down to 12. But you kind of wonder, what were the odds of everybody in front of me stepping over that wire, and then I come along, and I'm the guy that didn't step over the wire. I set it off, you know. And we didn't really use trails too much. We made our own trail because trails were booby-trapped. It was a common fact that trails are booby-trapped. When we could, we would... Just once personally, and that's because we were using a trail, and you kind of want to keep your distance. You don't want to get all clustered to one spot. We got a different word for it I won't use, but clustered. And this trail would twist and wind, and I didn't like using the trail, as anybody else didn't like it, but the trail branched off. And when it did, and I got to this Y, I stopped. I did not know which way to go. And you couldn't really start yelling, hey, you guys, you know, which way did you go? So I stopped until the guy behind me came up and said, what's the holdup? And I said, I lost him. He said, pick one and take it, you know. So I went to the left, and I walked about 100 feet and fell into an old punji pit. Thank God it was an old punji pit. And it was probably about this deep, and my boots smashed the band.
Can you explain more about what that
is? You know, these pits, they would dig these pits, and they could take a bamboo and sharpen their bamboo really to a point and stick them in the ground, and sometimes they put human feces on it to infect you. The Vietnamese, as I understand it, they really didn't want to kill us. They wanted to maim us. A number of death doesn't mean anything, but if you had to see all of your friends coming back with no legs, no arms, it really demoralized the whole war thing back here. So a lot of these booby traps were not designed to kill. They were designed to maim us. That was one form. Another booby trap we had to deal with over there, more of the point man than me, was the Bouncing Betty. You set this thing off. It had two charges. One charge of bouncing up about chest high, and then the second charge to set it off.
Can you go back? So you fell into a punch?
An older punch.
Actually, I'm sorry. Yeah, could you just start with, you were at these two, this Y.
Uh-huh.
Somebody came up behind you. Start with what he told you, and then go from there.
He was kind of aggravated with me. He said, what's the holdup? And I said, I don't know which way they went. He said, choose one. So I chose to the left. And I took off, and he stayed behind me because if he took off, he'd been right on my heels, so he was going to give me some distance. And I fell in this old bungee pit, and realized they didn't go this way. And I came back, and I said, they must have went to the right. But it hit me later that day. What had happened was I actually was entrapped in a booby trap. And if it hadn't been for the fact that this was all rotten, I would have been a casualty. But when my boots, and the boots did have steel plates in them, when my boots hit it, it just crumpled the bamboo, you know. It could have been a different type of booby trap. I would have probably hit that damn thing and set it off.
So you talked about on Wednesday that you earned a badge. What was this badge, and why was it the most important badge to you?
Well, I've got it right up here. That's my combat medic badge. The only way to get this as a medic is you have got to be in direct contact with combat and the enemy. And the way I got it was we had a guy named Jack that got what I call a million-dollar wound. They were screaming for the medic, and he was the very first casualty I went to. I want to say it was his right leg. He was laying on his stomach, and the round pierced his leg, did not shatter the femur. There was very little blood, and I was so nervous. I remember that I was trembling and shaking, and this guy was telling me to calm down, you know, that he was, you know, I'm okay, just take it easy. And I needed to cut his pants down like this, and I realized I had used my bayonet as a tent peg, and I didn't have my bayonet with me, so I was looking around for something to cut his pants off with, so I could see how bad it was. And finally, we got it ripped open, and there was very little seepage, and he didn't require any medication. I simply bandaged him up, shipped him out, and that was it. And because of that one thing, I got the CMB, Combat Medic Badge. It's the equivalent to the CIB. The CIB is called the Combat Infantryman Badge, and that goes to the straight infantryman. And then there's one for the combat medic. They hold the same weight, same level of whatever. It's the one medal. If you ask any Vietnam veteran that's got the CIB or the CMB, he'll tell you it's the one medal that means more than anything, because it shows you, it shows anybody else, I've been there. Lots of guys have died trying to get these things, guys that shouldn't have been in combat. There was a misconception that if you was an officer, especially a career officer, a pencil pusher, that if you wanted to get an advancement up to the field grade level, you had to have a CIB, combat infantryman. So they would go out on one mission and maybe come in contact with enemy just to get this. Sometimes they were in control, and they would get guys killed because they didn't know what to do. Yeah.
What did it mean to you when you got that, and has the meaning changed to you?
Nope. It's still intense. It means more than the Bronze Star. It means more than Army Commendation Medal. It means more than any other medal I got. This is the one I'm the most proud of. The rest of them I got, I kind of think I got them because they had too many of them sitting around. This one I know I earned. You know, you can get a Bronze Star for pushing papers around. You know, they call it meritorious service. Is that the right word, meritorious? You know, this is the one I know for a fact I earned. It's the one that means the most to me.
Having that pride, when you came back and there were still protests going on and people who were still opposed to the war, did you ever feel that you attacked by that? Or what were your perceptions of those people?
You know, the war was still going on when I came back, and I had to deal with this too, that not everybody felt the same way I did. I was at Fort Belvoir once, and just after I came back from Vietnam, and I'm somewhat dark complected anyway, and exposed to a lot of sunlight, I got very dark. And I stopped at the gas station to buy a pack of cigarettes. And there was a woman behind this counter that she kind of reminded me of Aunt Bee. She was just an older woman, looked like she could make an apple pie and get a blue ribbon. And she said, "You just get back from vacation in Florida?" And I said, "No, I just got back from Vietnam." And her whole attitude changed towards me. So I thought maybe I shouldn't tell people this. You know, maybe I should keep it to myself.
Tell us about what her attitude was at first and how,
I'm sorry.
And how that made you feel.
Well, it made me feel kind of like a...
Start with what was her attitude at first, and then what did it change?
I'll tell you exactly what she said if you don't mind.
No.
When I told her I just got back from Vietnam, her exact words were a big fucking deal. And I thought, okay, you know, I got it. I understand now. You know, now maybe she had had a son in Vietnam that was killed. I have no idea. But her whole attitude was just get your cigarettes and get the hell out of here. And she was an older lady. And this was actually Fort Belvoir was just outside of Washington, D.C., so there was a lot of protests going on then, too.
What did that comment mean to you? How did you feel about
that? It shocked me. You know, it just literally shocked me that somebody would say that to my face. I had a few things. My mother and my father were living in between Fort Belvoir and Washington, D.C. in a mobile home park. And I was visiting my mom and my dad. My dad was gone, but my mom said, you know what you need to do? You need to walk over here to Route 1 and get a bus and go on to Washington, D.C., to Georgetown, and get drunk and have a good time. And my mother had convinced me that this is what I should do because I didn't have a car. And so I took off walking, and I got to Route 1. There was, as I understand, this older black gentleman was making a living collecting pop bottles. He was riding a bicycle that had two baskets on the back of it full of pop bottles, and he was going from trailer to trailer asking for pop bottles. Route 1 was a four-lane road, very busy, and he tried riding his bicycle across this traffic instead of pushing it, and a white Valiant hit this guy and took his leg completely off, I mean, bang, and threw this leg over into this apartment complex. And he landed on the curb and hit his head. And the car, the white Valiant was driven by a white guy and a white woman. It took off, and there was blood all over the car. And I was right there. And I went to this gentleman on the ground, and I took my belt off and applied a tourniquet. He was probably dead already. And I kept yelling for somebody to call an ambulance, you know, call an ambulance. Actually, I think I was using the word dust off. And this apartment complex was full of black people. And they got around, and they started talking about this guy had took off. Apparently, his wife had talked him into coming back, you know, not to run. And when that car pulled up, they almost killed this guy. They drug him out, started beeping him. And by the time the police were there, and the fire truck was there, and the ambulance was there, and I never knew for a fact whether or not this old gentleman made it or not, but I feel pretty sure he did not make it. I went back to my mom's trailer. I had blood all over me. I said, I think I'll just stay home. I think I'll just stay home, you know. Now, that was one thing. And the other thing that happened there was I was with my two younger brothers, and somebody shot two rounds through my mom and dad's window, and I remember getting my brothers down on the floor very quickly. My wife would tell you even today I still have I'm very quick to react to loud noises and stuff. I guess you'll never get through that or away from that. But